Welcome to the September 2008 edition of Groundwire, a project by the National Campus and Community Radio Association, providing grassroots coverage of local issues with progressive perspectives on national and international issues. On this month's Groundwire, the Six Nation gathering held in late August, over 100 people meet in Tatamagouche, Nova Scotia for free school, and an in-depth look into the tar sands in Alberta. Stay tuned for these stories and more on Groundwire, but first up, the headlines. Workers from Montreal's largest hotel hit the streets to protest working conditions. David Koch has a story.
In the heart of downtown Montreal, dozens of striking hotel workers are picketing outside the main entrance to the Queen Elizabeth Hotel, attracting the honks of passing cars. Nearly 600 workers are on strike at the Queen E, the largest hotel in the province. They are represented by the Confederation of National Trade Unions, or CNTU. The CNTU's demands include a lighter workload for housekeeping staff, who currently clean 14 rooms per shift. The union wants to bring that number down to 13. Jennifer Cloutier, a housekeeper at the Queen Elizabeth, told CKUT the workers have complained of injuries on the job.
It was a housemaid that actually fell in the tub, and if he hadn't passed, she would have been still lying in the tub. He called security. Security came to pick her up. They came to see the situation, but they left her there. When he came back, the guy that spotted her from room service noticed that she was still there in tears in the tub. He had to bring her down.
Despite the strike, guests are still staying at the Queen Elizabeth, which is managed by the multinational Fairmont Hotels and Resorts. As they cross the picket line, hotel clients Greg and Peter King told CKUT that service has been okay during their stay. And in a press release last Thursday, the company said that, quote, the Queen Elizabeth will continue to maintain service to hotel guests with the support of management staff. However, Pascal Côté, the president of the CNTU local, accused the company of using scab labor.
If they were only the people who are allowed to work inside, they will have no service at all.
The strike at the Queen Elizabeth is the latest in a series of labor conflicts at hotels throughout the province this summer. Nearly 70 workers are also on strike at Montreal's Four Points Sheraton, and another 60 remain locked out at the Holiday Inn Longueuil. In Montreal, this is David Koch.
Conservatives abandon Bill C-484 and offer up C-543 in its place. Kate Lerman has more.
Bill C-484, termed the Unborn Victims of Crime Act, is considered by many to be no more. The bill passed one hearing in March, and although it's still being promoted by Ken Epps, the MP who introduced it, many consider it to be over and done with no chance of becoming law. Bill C-484 has seen opposition from groups across the country, including pro-choice groups, the Canadian Union for Public Employees, and the Canadian Medical Association. A new bill has been introduced by the Conservatives, Bill C-543, which is an act to amend the criminal code and the abuse of pregnant women. Conservative MP Rob Nicholson says the new legislation, which has not yet been tabled in the House of Commons, will not challenge the legality of abortion. Bill C-543 is being supported by the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. Despite the outcome of Bill C-484, events are still being planned on and around September 28th, originally called the National Day of Action Against Bill C-484. Joyce Arthur of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada is in charge of the Vancouver planning. She says that regardless of the outcome of Bill C-484 or C-543, building awareness is still important.
The more awareness we have, the more support we'll have, and the less support there'll be for the bill. So that's key. So if you're going to organize an event in your town or your city, the important thing is to get the media involved, let them know what's going on, and just educate people.
Graduate students at Queen's University are in the midst of a union drive.
While many students slow down during the summer months, a number of graduate students at Queen's University have been working extra hard. They are trying to change the fact that Queen's is one of the last universities in Ontario without a union. The Teaching Assistants and Fellows Association, or TAFA, came together last November, making this the third union drive in the past decade. Scott Rutherford, a Queen's graduate student and volunteer for TAFA, explains the justification for a union.
Being allotted a course that we had no experience teaching in, or if we were doing more work than we were being paid for, you know, complaining about the fact that we have no health or dental coverage other than what we pay into our graduate association ourselves. Just common grievances like that.
After researching several unions, TAFA decided to work with the Public Service Alliance of Canada. The group stresses the union promotes local autonomy and democratic decision-making. Scott Rutherford describes their approach to organizing.
They really stressed union building, which means that whether this drive succeeds or not, one of the main goals is to have people organizing a union, and the process of organizing a union is as important as actually the union itself.
Queen's has taken an official stance of neutrality on union organizing. A neutral position means that Queen's will not engage in an official anti-union campaign, nor will they stop any independent efforts to quash union organizing.
You are still listening to Groundwire, thanks to David Koch, Gretchen King, Kate Lerman, and Courtney Kirkby for those headlines. And now it's time for features. Natives and non-natives joined together on six nations of the Grand River Territory at an event organized by a grassroots committee of Six Nations residents and supporters. Aaron Lakoff of CKUT brings news from this event.
From August 21st to 23rd, the first ever Peace and Friendship Gathering was held at the Six Nations Iroquois Reserve in southern Ontario. The gathering, which is organized by the Men's Fire of Six Nations, was planned to honor the long struggle for survival by people from that territory, but also to honor the support which they have received throughout the years from non-Native people. On February 28, 2006, a group of Native women began a peaceful occupation of a home development site known as the Douglas Creek Estates on Six Nations land. The occupation was widely supported by community members of Six Nations and led to the successful stopping of housing development on Native lands, despite a brutal attack by the Ontario Provincial Police on Native protesters in April 2006. To this day, the people of Six Nations have succeeded in stopping the Douglas Creek Estates development on their land and many other development sites on Six Nations territory. The Peace and Friendship Gathering brought together hundreds of participants, Native and non-Native, to enjoy workshops, panel discussions, Iroquois ceremonies, and music. These are some of the sounds from that gathering, held on the banks of the Grand River in Six Nations territory.
We have a hard enough time holding our children up as we do now. I couldn't see that happening. And under our great law, it is the women's job not only to protect the land, but to protect the children for the next seven generations. And to see this destruction, not only of our land, but our nation, our children, we couldn't see that happen anymore. So this group of ladies, we got together. There was actually quite a few of us when we went in. There was 10 of us that went in that morning. And we took over Gatestado, and we never left. And that's the first time in Canadian history that a nation has taken them on, went to war with them, defeated them, and has held them back. It's been over 2 years now that we've went in. They declared war on us.
They said our people are not allowed to demonstrate or to stop construction on the on our lands, the destruction of our lands. Prior to that, there was Ruby and Floyd Montour, some elders from our community. They were going out. They threatened to bring the army in on them. So I decided right when that came out, I looked at a calendar and I says, I gotta decide when I'm gonna do this because I have to stand. And when I looked at the calendar, I says, well, not this weekend. I says, I'm going out for somebody's birthday on this weekend. That's the 4th. And as I looked the next weekend, and there's the 11th of July. And I remember that date because that's back in 90, That's when they tried to, they launched an attack on our one of our territories, Gunasadagi, Oka. And so I guess to kind of honor that, I kind of chose that date. We went in about 3:30 in the morning, and we just parked the trucks right in the laneway. And we said, and when they came there, we said, "No, you're not gonna go in." And everything that I've done peacefully. I sat there and I just told them no. And they came and they said, the cops came to me and they says, "Well, what if we just try to take you off?" I says, "You can probably take me off." I says, "There's only 5 of us." I says, "But you know what?" I says, "It might just piss my people off. There might be 500 here." I says, "Would you prefer?" Yeah.
Amongst the gathering speakers was former political prisoner Bob Lovelace, who was recently imprisoned for defending Algonquin land from uranium extraction in the Ottawa Valley.
Indigenous law in Canada forms part of the common law of Canada. And Judge Cunningham, the Superior Court in Kingston, in my sentencing, rejected that. When he sentenced me, I can remember his words very clearly. He said, "There's only one law. And that's the law of Canada, and that's the law of this court. And when I made that injunction, that's the only law that we recognize in Canada." What was interesting was that the Appellate Court of Ontario said, "That's not true. That's not true." Sarah Dover, where is she? She raised the point. She said, "In Osgoode Hall, there's a window, there's a stained glass window in this building, and it says that the Canadian law is made up of English common law, it's made up of French civil code, and it's made up of the Aboriginal or Indigenous customary law." And she said, "If you don't believe that, and if you find in some other way, hire some workmen and have that window removed from the building." And that's exactly what the appellate court upheld. They said that, you know, the court should have taken our customary law into consideration in terms of my sentencing. I think that's really important for Indigenous communities to really pay attention to their own laws, to be certain, to be sure of, and to understand and uphold their own laws. We can work within Canadian courts, but we also very much have to know the reality of our own laws.
And my message for you is, I hear so many times, "What can we do? What can we do to help you?" It's not you that we have the fight with. It never has been. From the moment that you got here, we have welcomed you. We have shared everything that we've had. It is with your government that we have the fight, the same government that you have the fight with. So if you want to know what to do, stand up, because the government is supposed to be of the people, by the people, for the people, not on top of the people. You are the people. You are the government.
This report was produced by CKUT's Aaron Lakoff, with music from the Six Nations Women Singers.
Over 100 people gathered in Tatamagouche, Nova Scotia to take part in the 4th annual Free School. Tim Crabtree has more.
The Tatamagouche Summer Free School in Tatamagouche, Nova Scotia is 4 days in late August of learning, discussion, relaxation, good food, interesting people, and sun. Over 120 participants camped in fields, tents, and barns at the Waldegrave Farm in Tatamagouche. The free school schedule included ongoing discussion groups, workshops, movies, a keynote presentation, and contra dancing. Hilary Lindsay lives on Waldegrave Farm and was an organizer of the 4th annual free school.
It's based on the philosophy that everyone has something to teach and everyone has something to learn. And it's kind of a non-hierarchical education model where people come together, and you don't often get the opportunity or the space, if you're not a professor or a teacher, to offer something that you've learned in your life or to learn more about something you're really passionate about and then decide to offer it to other people.
Waldegrave Farm was incorporated on a community land trust model, combining the interests of the community and the environment. Those who live on the land can't make a profit from it. Yule Herbert, one of the 10 permanent residents on Waldegrave Farm, explained the concept.
Yeah, well, the community land trust tries to remove the property from the private property system permanently so that it's always a public land in perpetuity. So that way it makes it very affordable in the future and accessible to anyone. And it changes the way people think about land from a commodity to a place.
Because around here I see a lot of farms that are going up for sale and they're turning into cottages or whatever, or clear cuts, and seems like a critical time because we really do need farmland more than ever.
The feedback about the free school was overwhelmingly positive from participants.
The concept of this farm in itself is appealing in itself because of the cooperative amongst the people that are here and their goal of self-sustainability and building a community. And the free school is exactly, I think, the same thing. It's a cooperative of education and community building and everything else.
The response is always overwhelming from people, lots of people saying, oh, it was a, you know, highlight of my summer or whatever, which is a pretty major thing to say. So, yeah, that's the biggest sign.
Free schools currently exist from coast to coast, including the free school at the Montreal Urban Community Sustainment Project, the Halifax Free School, and the Indigenous Free School in Vancouver. Some workshops given at the free school were hands-on, such as masonry, woodworking and composting, while others were more theoretical, including translation, metadata and restorative justice in public schools. Discussion groups ranged from solidarity with First Nations, gender identity, to post-materialism. The keynote speaker was Chief Hugh Akagi from the Passamaquoddy First Nation. Passamaquoddy territory straddles the US-Canadian border in New Brunswick in Maine. Chief Hugh spoke about the Canadian Supreme Court's non-recognition of Aboriginal oral history and the example of the Dalgamuk decision.
When you understand what oral history really is, it's the stories. And we can go a long ways with that. We can talk about Dalgamuk, the 25-year battle for oral history, a people that were told, kicked out of courts, told by judges not to disturb his courtroom, went to a Supreme Court, wrote their history in a set of novels that would cover that wall, only to have a judge tell them that's not real history, it wasn't written at the time. Supreme Court says, well, we'll have a look at it, but they could help. And the help came from a scientist who was looking at the oral history, recognized something, went to a piece of scientific information, linked the two, came up with a date that science couldn't date, went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, whoops, looks real to me. Oral history is real. So the people with the Dalgamuk decision won that case, but they didn't win. I shouldn't say they won the case. They won that issue, but they did not win the case. After 25 years, they won the right to have their oral history recognized. And then they had to get up and start the battle all over again.
For Groundwire, this is CKDU's Tim Crabtree reporting from Halifax.
The majority of oil sands in Canada are located in northern Alberta. What does this mean for Albertans and Canadians as the demand for oil grows? Noel Thomas reports on the tar sands.
I'm Noel Thomas. As early as 1742, records show that Aboriginal people used the Athabasca tar sands in Alberta for heat and to seal the seams of their canoes. Today, the natural gas and water in Alberta are being plundered because it's all over oil.
Oil is basically blood, the body of capitalism. So you have to take the blood out, and you're going to have to do something about the body as well.
That's MacDonald Steensby.
MacDonald Steensby. I'm the coordinator of both the website and organization, oilsandstruth.org. It's in opposition to the tar sands gigaproject. It's based out of Edmonton. The way that the oil is produced is strip mining processes, which involve several tons of earth to get one barrel of oil. It's the largest single industrial project in human history. The reasons behind that have everything to do with two major factors. One is consuming oil at a 10-to-1 rate for the amount it's currently discovering, and the massive spike of oil that began in price shortly after the invasion of Iraq. This involves the clear-cutting of forests at the second-fastest rate on the planet. It involves 3 to 4 times the production of greenhouse gas emissions producing climate change. It is currently damaging the rivers by dropping levels tremendously.
That's because it takes 2 to 5 barrels of water to get 1 barrel of oil.
On the Athabasca River, where most of the strip mining is occurring, their community is seeing exponentially high and unexplained rates of very rare cancers. There's 5 indigenous communities in the region. The major affected community would be Fort Mackay. If you spend time in Mackay, you constantly smell what you and I would probably know from walking down the street when somebody was tarring the roof. That's in everybody's living room constantly. The areas surrounding have all been cleared and devastated. You walk out into the street and kick the driveway, if it's a dirt driveway, which almost everything there is, you'll find black bitumen stuff comes up under your feet. The aims of the U.S. Department of Energy, with the Canadian government, as well as the corporations operating in the area, are to get between 4 and 5 million barrels a day out of the tar sands by the year 2030.
From Democracy Now!, July 15th, 2008, Amy Goodman.
Our guest is Naomi Klein. She's a Canadian journalist. The majority of this new oil coming to the United States is coming from the Alberta tar sands, which are often called the oil sands. This is another oil industry talking point to get you to stop calling it the tar sands and start calling it the oil sands. It's locked into the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which makes it illegal for Canada to turn off the tap, even if Canada has an oil crisis.
Let's back up for a moment to understand why a large percentage of Canada's oil is exported to the U.S. Remember, Canada is part of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
WBAI, New York.
From a November 1993 WBAI radio program.
I'm Amy Goodman here with Bernard White. Right now we're joined on the phone by a woman from Canada. She broke her story to the Montreal Mirror. Welcome to the WBAI morning show, Shelley-Ann Clark.
Very delighted to be with you this morning.
In the United States, we are dealing with the North American Free Trade Agreement. Can you tell us what you were asked to do during the 1988 Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement?
I would be called in for midnight in the trade negotiations office to alter key documents and to delete key paragraphs from the documents that would be viewed by the province. The alterations were dealing with figures of the amount that we were giving away and what we were getting in return.
Again, MacDonald Steensby.
Canada is the largest oil-producing country in the world without a national petroleum reserve. What we see now is through the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the SPP, and similar things like TILMA, or Trade Investment Labor Mobility Agreement between Alberta and British Columbia, labor standards are being dropped on both sides of the border.
What's bad about the Security and Prosperity Partnership is it is a business deal.
Maud Barlow, the Council of Canadians National Chairperson, from a 2008 interview.
And in order to keep the border open for that business, they have convinced the Canadian and Mexican governments to adopt George Bush's War on Terror policy. The big business agenda is great, and we get to make more money at the same time, and we get to use cheap Mexican labor.
MacDonald Steensby.
In Canada, they're going to be using temporary foreign worker programs to bring in, by estimations of what will be needed, probably tens of thousands of people who will not have the right to apply to become even legal immigrants, let alone full citizens.
Who are some of the oil and gas companies operating in Alberta's tar sands?
We have Sinenco, Syncrude, there's Suncor. Imperial Oil is heavily involved in both pipeline as well as drilling and digging operations. Shell has a major plant, Dad Oil from Norway.
Norway, compared to Canada, has created a fund totaling billions of dollars from oil profits for its future generations. I asked MacDonald Steensby why Canada doesn't do the same.
Both the federal government and the provincial governments of Alberta have done very little. In fact, when Ralph Klein finished his term of office, he admitted on his way out there was absolutely no plan in place how to manage any of the revenues, how to manage the housing crisis. There's just no plan in place for the environment or anything of that sort. The federal government tries to keep its hands off of Alberta. Alberta has a history of being incredibly resentful for federal government interference. The premier of Alberta has declared that he will not touch the brakes on this production. That's almost a direct quote.
Solutions. Can you suggest any?
Best thing I would suggest is go to the oilsandstruth.org website and click on the sidebar for the satellite maps, because they show the path of the various pipelines and at that point figure out if there's a local angle that they can resist on. For example, people in northern BC don't want to see tanker traffic off the coast.
And what do you think might be the alternative to the tar sands or to the oil glut?
There is not really one that is an honest one in a lot of ways. There is no way within, as far as I can tell, the system to repair what oil is, which is basically the blood of the body of capitalism. So we're going to have to come up with an entirely new order, and we're going to have to start looking at non-industrial models to be able to survive.
Again, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!
NASA's top climate scientist, James Hansen, warned the world has long passed the dangerous level for greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and that the Earth is nearing a tipping point. During an interview on NPR, Hansen called for the chief executives of oil companies to be tried for their role in spreading disinformation on climate change.
For more information, go to oilsandstruth.org, democracynow.org, canadians.org. The music and sounds were by the Northern Cree Singers of Saddle Lake, Alberta, R. Carlos Nakai, Lalo Schifrin, and Richard Lamy. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Groundwire. Tweet us by email. Send your feedback to groundwire@ncra.ca. This has been Groundwire, community news from across Canada. This month's edition of Groundwire was mixed by CKUT in Montreal. For more information, visit us at groundwire.ncra.ca.